Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, May 11th, 2014, and this is show number 470. Do you realize this Tuesday, the NoCillaCast will be 9 years old? No big celebration, but wait until next year. That's going to be really exciting. But you know what? Now might be a good time to drop by iTunes again. You get to do this once a year. Maybe drop in a comment or a rating for the show. It really helps to get the show noticed, so it'd be awesome if you could go help out that tiny little bit. You don't have to say anything nice, but you could if you want to. Well, this week I got to be the guest on Tom Merritt's awesome daily news show called The Daily Tech News Show over at dailytechnewsshow.com. It was really fun to kind of trade back and forth with him, having him on our show last Sunday and then me being on his show this week. That was really, really fun. He's such a brilliant and funny guy. I just love getting to work slash play with him much more these days now that I'm unemployed. Or retired, as they like to call it. Anyway, had a lot of fun with him. Go check it out. There's a link in the show notes to the exact episode. It was Tuesday of last week. Speaking of last week, on the show, I said I was going to put my money where my mouth is and give away my free 6 months of the awesome VPN Cloak service, or service called Cloak. They gave this to me at Macworld, free 6 months, and I am pleased to announce that Christopher Justice is the lucky winner. He has already been notified. I did also learn something else that might give you even more joy than begrudgingly congratulating Christopher through gritted teeth. Last week, I said that Cloak was $3.99 a month, but when I went to actually pay for it myself, month to month, it's only $2.99 a month, $2.99. I know that makes my gesture just a little bit less grandiose, 25% less grandiose, actually, but it's still good news for you if you want to get the Cloak VPN service. Oh, I should mention that's for 5 gigabytes a month. So, you know, if you're a reasonably casual user, that's a lot. 5 gig is a ton. And remember, it works on all your devices. It works on your Mac, on your iPhone, I believe it, and your iPad. I believe it does Android PCs. I mean, it's on everything. Awesome, awesome software. But definitely on all your iOS and Mac devices. And that's at one fee for everything. Anyway, I should explain that I use an elaborate process to choose the winners of these kinds of giveaways. First, I put the email addresses of the people who enter into a spreadsheet in the order in which they enter. Then I use the RAND function to assign a random number between 0 and 1 to each person. I copy the results and paste the values back in so I can sort by that number. If you don't do that, random just keeps recalculating new random numbers, so you don't actually get them in order. Now, I had a little bit of a problem this time because I tried using numbers instead of my beloved Excel just to see if it could do it. Turns out they don't have paste values inside numbers, but after some time with the Googles, I discovered that paste formula results does the same thing and actually kind of makes a little bit of sense. Lucky for numbers, I would have had to have done some serious angry tweeting about that. Wait, guys, I need your help. Steve's parents are very security conscious and, like all of us, struggle with multiple passwords. Steve's dad, Ken, and I have spent a great deal of time discussing what makes a good password, and he trusts my advice on how to strengthen his own. I've showed him Steve Gibson's password haystack, where you can learn what the effect of adding more characters and more types of characters can do to affect how long it takes to get your password cracked. I like this tool because it helped me illustrate how a password generated. He had read an article that said you should use the first letter of a phrase, and that makes it a random set of letters, and that makes it really hard to crack. Well, the problem was it wasn't that hard to crack because it was only 8 characters long, and everybody knows you got to be a lot more than 8 characters these days. Even though he had substituted a number for one of the letters, it didn't take more than minutes for it to be cracked in an offline scenario with a good compute server. Theoretically, that is. With Passwords Haystacks, I was able to show him how padding his password with some meaningless special characters, even repeating them so it's easy to remember, that took it into the hundreds of centuries to crack if he doubled it in length. He was delighted that there was an easy solution to making it secure. However, Steve's parents are so security conscious that they don't yet trust the idea of a password manager. Having all that information in one place is a concern for them, and it's hard to make a good argument, but I'm just barely getting a crack into them that their own ability to create and safely secure a good set of random passwords is much worse than the possibility of something like LastPass or 1Pass even being able to be cracked. Like I said, I think I'm getting close to talking into it, but then I got to thinking, how well will they adapt to the less than perfect experience you get with these password managers? I'm a big believer in them, but there's problems. For example, today we switched Apple TVs running in our house. So when we went to HBO Go to play Game of Thrones, it asked for an authorization code. You know what that meant? That meant finding a computer. Well, they're laying around, of course, but going on the computer, going to hbogo.com/authorize. Then it had to say, oh, but what ISP are you using? So I had to find Verizon Fios in the list, and then I had to enter my username and password. Luckily, that time it worked flawlessly with LastPass as my browser plugin. But then I went to my credit union, and they expect the username on one page, and after you click go, only then do you get to enter your password. So LastPass just got totally confused. Oddly, it didn't enter the username, but it does recognize the password field. I think some sites use a pop-up that evidently is completely invisible to LastPass or some sort of non-standard language, and it doesn't enter anything at all. I know all I have to do is click on the LastPass icon in the browser toolbar, search for the site, and select password, but it's an extra step beyond the magic it can sometimes do. Now, picture this in Steve's dad's hands. Ken is quite clever and is a fabulous resource on things like investment advice, but he is completely stymied when things don't go, when they don't act predictably on the computer. For example, last weekend after we left him from visiting, he sent me a very concerned email that he had a large pop-up on his screen that was from Apple, and it was demanding that he upgrade to Mavericks, and he was very upset about it. It took me a while to figure out what had happened. Before I left, I'd opened the App Store, on his Mac right before I left to see if his machine was eligible to upgrade to Mavericks, and I just forgot to close it. But this kind of irregularity just throws him for a loop. Things must behave consistently or he gets very upset. Now, Steve's mom is much more adaptable and tolerant of inconsistent behavior, but on the other hand, I'm not as close to convincing her that a password manager will be more secure than what she's doing right now. Now, I have very little experience with 1Password. I tested it a few years ago, and it didn't jive completely with the way I thought, and I didn't see a compelling reason to change from LastPass, but I know that a lot of people really like it. Now, Dorothy, also known as MacLurker in the chat room and on Twitter, she did an exhaustive analysis of the two applications feature by feature, and when she got done, she had to toss a coin to decide which to use because they were both awesome options. So I'm not ever going to say anything bad about either one of them, I mean, unless I find something bad. So then I'm thinking, well, which one would be the right one for Ken and Merlee? What would be the right way to go for people who are unsophisticated users but very security conscious, but maybe not adaptable to a lot of freaky weirdness? So I decided to run a poll over on podfeet.com now that I have all this lovely empty real estate in my sidebars to use for temporary exercises, and I asked this question. I said, if the user is really non-technical but very security conscious, uses a Mac and an iPad, which would be easier for him or her to use, LastPass or 1Password? Well, the results after a week came back 68% in favor of 1Password, 16% in favor of LastPass, and 16% saying that both are equally easy or hard for this type of user. I posted about the poll in Twitter, Facebook, and our Google Plus community over at podfeet.com/Google Plus. And as is usually the case, the most interesting conversation happened over in Google Plus. Jim Sewell suggested that the results might be weighted towards 1Password due to the culture of 1Password users being involved in Macs and podcasts, so a higher percentage might be using 1Password. Kim Landwehr finds using 1Password across Mac, iPad, and Android problematic. She says it keeps creating duplicates, like 4 different Facebook logins. I was bummed to hear from Alistair Jenks that 1Password also gets confused by websites who present their login pages in non-standard ways, and people are saying that same thing in the live chat right now. I was really hoping it was a LastPass problem and that if I had them on 1Password it wouldn't happen, but it looks like it's more a standardization of the web problem. Alistair did note that it seems to be getting better at recognizing password fields, that's 1Password, but I think LastPass is getting better too. John Ormsby noted that I might have asked the wrong question. He suggested I should have started the question with, for people who've tried both, that would have given me purer results. I wonder how many people have tried both. I think 1Password is prettier than LastPass, so maybe that would help the barrier to entry by a more novice user. Then again, if he gets stuck, I really need to be able to be the one to get him out of a jam, so I'd better be really versant in the tool. That would mean I'd need to switch to 1Password to get good at it before letting him loose in the tool. I talked a bit to Bart about it this afternoon when we were recording Chit Chat Across the Pond, and he suggested that letting them run 1Password as a standalone tool where they always just went and copied the password and pasted it might be something that they would understand more. That kind of concept of like now they go and get a piece of paper and they get it off of that and they put it back in. That conceptually might make more sense to them than trying to do this autofill thing. So maybe that's an option. But you could also do that with LastPass because there is, you know, you can log into your LastPass vault and copy and paste the password and maybe that would help them. I don't know. Anyway, I'd really appreciate any thoughts on this before as I get up my nerve to help Steve's parents get more secure. I might have to make a lot of clarified tutorials and maybe even some screencasts to help them get started. I've been experimenting around with something that might shock you. OneNote from Microsoft. You might think that's crazy, but hey, it's free. It runs on all my iOS and Mac devices, so why not give it a try and see if it solves some problems? If you love Evernote and every time you open it, you feel happy and it thinks just the way you think, then you should probably tune out and go read or listen to something else because you don't have a problem to be solved. I like Evernote, but I'm never entirely comfortable in there. It seems to be a bit hinky at all times. Formatting is kind of weird. Finding things seems harder to me than it should be with all this tagging nonsense. And I just don't reach for it as often as true believers do. I don't dislike it, but I don't love it. OneNote has so many fans on the PC side, I figured there must be something awesome about it, so I decided to give it a try. When Don McAllister did a screencast over on Screencast Online, I got even more excited. Let's dig in and see how OneNote works. OneNote's value is increased dramatically by having a Live account by Microsoft. Your Live account will allow your notes to be synced across all of your devices, and since they give away gobs of free storage, there's not much downside to giving in and registering a free account with Microsoft. Unless you hate the whole idea of any kind of cloud syncing, like Dorothy, in which case you'd actually hate this idea. OneNote has a very familiar look with the now ubiquitous ribbon interface, but it's somehow much cleaner and simpler looking than the Office ribbon. When you launch OneNote, you're given your first notebook, which I think is the name of the first notebook is your email address. At least that's what it did for me. Mine was called AllisonofPodfeet.com's notebook. Unfortunately, OneNote on the Mac and iOS does not let you rename notebooks, so this first one is super dumb. I'd create separate notebooks right away, like one for home and one for work, at least to separate the ideas in some reasonable way. You also can't move notes from notebook to notebook without just copy and pasting. One of the awesome features of OneNote is that you can actually share an entire notebook with someone. That's cool, but did you notice I said entire notebook? You can't just share like one section, it's all or nothing. So let's say you create a home notebook and want to share the section on your kitchen remodel, you'll also be sharing the section on your doctor visit about that weird rash on your foot. It's dumb that you can't share a section, but if you keep that restriction in mind when creating your notebooks, you should be okay. For each notebook, you can create sections, like I mentioned, which are pretty tabs right under the ribbon. Those you can rename and slide around to reorder to your heart's content. On the right sidebar within a section tab, you can add pages. This notebook section page metaphor works really well for me and makes a lot of sense. I like it a lot better than the loosey-goosey tag everything concept over in Evernote. I know you can make notebooks over there, but something about it doesn't sync up with me. It still feels like anarchy over there in Evernote to me. Now we've got a notebook, we've got some sections, and we have a starting page. OneNote is very unusual in that you're not just stuck in some single page text field. When you click on the page and start typing, you're actually in a text box that just kind of floats around on the page. You can drop in images and slide them around as well. I'm still getting used to the idea of not being restricted on where I can type, but I think it's kind of a nice freedom. A little bit of anarchy is okay. Text fields can have a variety of purposes and formats. For example, you can set your text box items to be a to-do list. Makes nice little checkboxes next to each item. Well, that looks super useful, but the existence of the checkbox is all you've actually done. There's no organization of to-do items, no reminders to tell you to do them. It's just a formatting change. They're just drawing a box next to it. It's cute and easy to use, but it sure won't remind me to get anything done. As soon as I turn the page, boom, it's gone. Likewise, you can format them as a question, and you get a question mark, like you can just type a question mark at the end of your question. I don't know. How about an address? Puts a little house next to what you type. Doesn't format it as an address, doesn't give you separate fields in which to type, doesn't sync up with your address book. It's just an adorable little house icon. There's a lot more options over there, but I think we'll just skip the rest of them. You can insert tables into your notes, which is pretty useful, actually. They're not spreadsheet tables, so don't expect to do any math in them. But, you know, a lot of times you just want to make information a little more structured, and a table could be a good way to do that. When you select to insert a table, you get a grid, so you can drag to how many rows and columns you want. Once the table is inserted, you have super obvious icons that allow you to insert and delete rows and columns. Works very well. You can also insert dates and times, which I guess could be pretty useful. I really like the way they implemented links. You just select any text, click the Insert Link button, and very clearly you can see what will be displayed in the link that it will follow. Nice and clean. A lot of effort went into making OneNote look pretty. And while more functionality is usually what I go for, they really did make this application pleasing to look at. Back in Evernote, it's sort of harsh to me. The icons are harder to understand because they're so small. The real test, though, was when I opened up OneNote on my iPad. It is gorgeous. They did a really good job of making clear icons that are easy targets for fat fingers. At first, I was really confused how the syncing worked because I only had the one notebook that my account started, you know, the AllisonAtPodFeet.com's notebook. I tapped Sync All, and it showed that it synced, but all of the other notebooks I created on my Mac were not there. I noticed an icon on the left that said Open. When I tapped on it, that showed connected services, including my OneDrive storage area. OneDrive is like Dropbox, only with more storage and some more interesting applications. Once I tapped on my OneDrive storage, I could see all of the notebooks I'd created. I think this is actually a good thing because you don't have to clog up your portable device with notebooks that you don't need to view, but you can get access to them when you need them. I opened a notebook on the iPad, changed something, and then tapped the very obvious sync button, and in a few seconds, the notebook on my Mac automatically changed. Great. Unfortunately, there's a big fall down of OneNote on the iPad. Unless I'm just being a moron, I can't figure out how to move things around on the page using my finger. And I'm talking about like moving those text boxes. Remember I said the text boxes and the images can move around? I can't figure out how to move them. As soon as I tap on a text box, the keyboard comes up and I can mess with the text, but I can't grab the box to drag it around or resize it. I also tried inserting a table and it made it exactly 2x2 cells with no options to add or delete rows or columns. I was able to mess around a little bit. Where did I figure that out? Somewhere I figured out how to fix that problem. But I did actually check with Don McAllister and asked him, have you been able to figure out how to move things around with your finger on the iPad? And he said, nope, can't do it. Unfortunately, while they made this interface beautiful and intuitive on the iPad, it's more of a consumption application or at best where you could modify things you've already written on the desktop. If you want even more access to your notes, though, you can actually log into OneNote.com and use OneNote via the web. It seems to function as you'd hope. In fact, remember how I said on the iOS version you could move things around? Turns out if you navigate to OneNote.com on the iPad, this is where it was. You can move things around. You can even edit tables inside OneNote.com. You can have all kinds of fun. Now, I have to say the app is much prettier, so if it meets your needs, it's a better experience. But if you find something you just can't do, it's good to know you can resort to the web interface if you need to. Chris Ashley of the SMR Podcast shared a notebook with me that has their show notes in it, and it worked flawlessly. I had written my notes in OneNote, so I did have to copy and paste to their notebook, but it was very easy to do. We didn't do any real-time collaboration, so it wasn't. I didn't figure out whether you could do it like editing a Google Doc, but it worked perfectly for our needs. Now, the real question will be whether I'll start using OneNote more and more and slow down on Evernote. Can't say for sure. The Evernote integration with Clarify will definitely keep at least one of my feet in that camp, but I wouldn't be surprised if I use OneNote for a lot more stuff in the future. I have a plan to trick Dorothy and Pat into using it for the class we're taking, the class notes, for an iOS program course that we're taking. I think this could be fun. We'll see if I can trick Dorothy into getting a Microsoft Live account. Steve and I are both runners, and we love listening to podcasts while we run. We both used to use the little iPod Nanos, and we love them. You know, the ones with a clip? But when Apple got rid of the little clip version, we knew that it was time to finally start using our iPhones. We weren't totally against the idea of switching anyway, especially since it would free us from using iTunes on the desktop and all that syncing nonsense. The reason we hesitated to use our iPhones for running was because we both hated all of the ways to hook them to your body. I hate armbands in particular. I can't believe I see people using these things. I'd used one ages ago on the long-form iPod Nanos that didn't actually weigh that much, but they were always slipping. I was always messing with it while I was running. I hated them. When Rod Simmons of the SMR Podcast told me about the Spy Belt, I had my solution. I talked about this Bi Belt a few shows back. It's a thin, adjustable belt with a kind of stretchy pouch that you squeeze your iPhone into. I wear mine on the front, Steve wears his on the back, and in both positions they stay firmly against us, no slipping, no bouncing. We have a great solution. But there's another problem to be solved. Apple's earbuds practically repel themselves out of Steve's ears. I thought he was just being a whiner at first, but it's comical how they just fall right out the minute he puts them in. I like the Apple earbuds for walking, but when I run, the cord pulls down too much and it irritates me when it bounces. For this reason, we both use over-the-ear headphones from Sony. Now, we don't go for Sony because they have some high fidelity or anything. We just like how they fit, they have acceptable audio quality, and because they're over-the-ear, they're ideal for jogging. Now, it's about time I actually get to the actual problem, because you can tell we have two solutions there. When we have our iPhones happily ensconced inside our spy belts, the headphones are plugged in and the podcast is blathering away, we have no easy way of stopping the podcast, say, to talk to someone we know on the Strand, or even to talk to each other when we get back from our runs. Especially in Steve's case, since it's around behind his back, it's a matter of minutes to get the phone out to stop the podcast. It's a bit easier for me with it out in front, but it's still a hassle. If we were wearing Apple earbuds, we'd be able to simply squeeze the remote control on the headphone wire to pause the show. The Apple earbuds also have volume up-down, which would be really useful when I'm running past the really loud street sweeper that goes along the Strand in the morning to clear out the previous night's windy sand. Turns out, there's a way for Steve and me to have our cake and eat it too. Several companies sell a little adapter cable that connects to the existing headphone cable to give you the same remote controls you have with iPhone earbuds. We tested a couple of these. The Belkin headphone adapter with remote for Apple iPod Shuffle. Is that long enough? And it's got the shuffle on it. And the I Love iPod remote with third-party headphone adapter. But those aren't the only ones out there. Skosh makes one and others as well. Both Steve and I are absolutely delighted with these adapters. We can now control volume and can play, pause, our podcast without removing our phones from our spy belts. As we played with them, we realized that they can actually do pretty much everything the iPhone earbuds can do. For example, did you know that if you press the plus or minus button on your earbud headphones, you can take a photo with your camera? As Steve Kyle pointed out, don't make sure I tell people you have to have the headphones plugged into the phone when you do that. Anyway, this makes it way easier to take a selfie with a good back-facing camera and then trying to tap that button when it's facing away from you. I can never hit that. But this works perfectly well with these adapter cables. We also tested some more advanced functions that the Apple earbuds give you, and these worked as well on these third-party adapters. The way the functions work is highly dependent on the application you're using. For example, with our adapters and Apple's earbuds, a double click on the center of the adapter in Pocket Cast skips forward 45 seconds. That's awesome for some podcasters who might drone on and on in their ads. Now, I never do that, of course, but, you know, for the other podcasters. If you're using iTunes on the iPhone, actually it's not iTunes, what's it called? Podcasts on the iPhone, the same double click skips to the next song podcast. So it's a little different between the two applications. If you double click and hold on Pocket Cast, it jumps to the next song podcast. While in the podcast app, it fast forwards. Anyway, the good news is that the functions that you know and love from your Apple earbuds can be used on any headphones if you get one of these adapters. Turns out you can even initiate Siri with these adapters using a long single press, but since the adapters don't have a microphone, you'll actually be using the built-in microphone in your iPhone and listening via your headphones. The Belkin adapter is only $13 on Amazon, but it's been discontinued by Belkin, so you may want to move out quickly on that when hit the link in the show notes. It's 6.5 inches long, so it gives you just a little bit of extra length, which actually works out perfect for me. Because I had an adapter to my headphones that actually an extension cable. That made it way too long, but without any extension, it was too short and it pulled funny. With this 6.5 inch long Belkin adapter, it fits perfectly. The iLove adapter is a bit easier to click to, which could be an advantage, but it's $20 and it actually extends your headphone by 12 inches. Steve liked these adapters so much he's put one in his car because he uses his iPhone via the headphone jack and he'll be able to start and stop his podcast without having to drag the phone out of the pocket in his dash. The extra length of the adapter makes it more accessible for him too. Like I said, I put links in the show notes to both the Belkin and iLove, and I think I have one to the Skosh adapter. But there's more to choose from, so if you think this would solve a problem you have, you can go look them up. Now, after I wrote all of this up and posted it up on podfeet.com midweek, like I do with my blog post now, Kirsten reminded me she did a review of the iLove back on show number 364. I had entirely forgotten about that. She shouldn't feel bad, though, because you can't believe how many times I search Google for a question and I find the answer on my own website, and I was the one who wrote the tutorial or the answer to it. Anyway, great minds think alike, Kirshen. This week, my brother Grant called me as he was having trouble burning a DVD. If you're not a geek, copying a DVD that doesn't even have copy protection on it is a daunting task. He's a reasonably bright boy and all that, but he's not technically inclined. Over the phone, Steve and I showed him how to create a disk image using Disk Utility and made sure that he created a CD-DVD master. After that, we showed him how to burn the DVD itself, the media itself, but for some reason, the HP media he was using just kept failing to burn. Luckily, I've run into this kind of thing before, and I said, just go out and buy any other brand. I explained it might not fix the problem, but he should hope it would work, because the other possible problem would be that it was his burner itself. Trotted back to the store and tried again, and it worked. Yay! Then he tried to rip and burn the second of the three DVDs he needed to copy, and it didn't work, so he called me again. We went through step by step, and he'd gotten tangled up looking for things that came up on screen in the wrong order, so he was confused, but I walked him through it again, and again he succeeded. Then he asked me sadly, how on earth am I going to remember this when it's time for the third DVD? I then told him that this is one of the problems that Clarify solves for me. I told him I do a lot of crazy stuff that's terribly hard to remember, so when I'm dorking around figuring things out, I open Clarify, I take screenshots, and annotate them so I can remember how to do these things. When I'm doing this for myself, I often don't take much care in how well I even document it, but often I go back and clean them up in case someone else were to need these instructions. I told him that the funny thing is that I often forget that I've done this. Just like I was just talking about, I'll Google for the solution. I'll find a tutorial that I just wrote. I tell him how dumb I feel when this happens, but at least I get really good documentation out of the deal. If you find it hard to remember how to do stuff on your Mac or PC, I can't recommend Clarify enough, even if it's only for yourself. Go check out the free beta download of Clarify 2. You can keep playing with it until they come out with the full version. Go get it over at clarify-it.com and see for yourself how useful it is. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchat. Lovely to chat with you. Thanks for coming in a little late this afternoon.
Afternoon is an interesting term for this time, but okay.
Well, I figured, I don't know what time it is anywhere, but I appreciate making a little time for me to get my mother's memorial service all done and get started and get back to work here today.
Okay. Well, hopefully it was a nice service.
It was lovely. It was lovely. It was fun. It was happy. We laughed. We had a good time, and we wore red. So she would have liked that, I think.
I never got to meet the Pod Mom in the flesh, but it sounds, you know, having sort of known her through you and chatted to her on Skype a few times, it sounds like what she, you know, I think she'd like.
I think so. Well, let's go ahead and get started. We got some security light this week.
We do. Since we were last speaking to each other, there was a 0 day in Internet Explorer, kind of a scary one. The whole every single version of Internet Explorer ever is vulnerable, and basically you just visit a website and you're hacked. You know, the really bad kind of 0 day in IE. Actually, this one even made the media to the point where people who are not IT savvy were asking questions like, so what can I use instead of IE? Or does that mean the internet can't be used? I was like, well, you can replace the E icon with a different icon. And they fixed it, which is good. And then
they
surprised
it really quickly. They didn't wait for the next Patch Tuesday, because I think it happened like the day after Patch Tuesday.
It did happen. It happened, I think, literally hours after we recorded last.
Yeah.
It's like, as soon as I started up my RSS reader, it went, Microsoft here, like, oh, crud. they didn't out of band patch because it was a serious emergency, and in the wild 0 day remote code execution, that's the kind of thing you have to jump on. And they did. And then they surprised absolutely everyone by patching it for Windows XP.
Really? Yep. Well, that's interesting, since the end of life to XP 15 minutes ago, right?
Yeah, effectively. You know, a few weeks ago.
That was a good move then, right? I mean,
short term, yes.
Do you think it made people go, oh, so it's not really dead?
Yeah, so short term, definitely a good move, because there are lots of people on XP. They were all vulnerable horribly. But by doing this, does that mean they're going to stay on XP and assume it's safe? Now, just because Microsoft patched this one bug, they're not patching everything. They've just patched this like major gaping wound. But the other stuff isn't being patched, so you're going to have this false sense of security thing setting in. So medium term, I'm not really sure it is actually that good, but short term it is good, and I'm sure a lot of people are relieved.
Hmm.
Yeah. Adobe also had a 0 day.
Oh, nice. Something for everyone.
Something for everyone in good old Flash. Nice cross-platform jobby. Also rushed out an out-of-band patch. In their case, they weren't retiring anything, so nothing particularly controversial about it. Standard fare at this stage. Adobe are pretty quick to get 0 days patched, and they don't wait for their patch cycle. They just do it, which is good.
Good, good.
So moving on to important security news, Apple have acknowledged the existence of a flaw in iOS that doesn't properly encrypt email attachments. This is not obviously good, but it's not a catastrophe because in order for the attack, in order for anyone to be able to utilize this flaw in any meaningful way, they either have to have physical access to your phone or you have to have jailbroken it. And of course, by jailbreaking it, you strip out all of its security and effectively it then can be attacked remotely, which is not good. So jailbroken phones are suffering much worse here.
I heard it was also only certain phones, too, like 4s or 4Ss and before, that it wasn't the more recent phones, no?
I don't know. I've heard things both ways on that.
So the article you showed to AppleInsider.com says using an iPhone 4, he was able to attach, that the attachments could be read without encryption.
Yeah, but I've seen people say it also works on the newer ones.
Yeah, this says
so I don't know. I'm just sort of assuming it's a problem with iOS, but it's...
I'm not sure it is. He said the article you pointed to says exploiting flaw requires physical access or iPhone 4 only jailbreak. So maybe it's physical access to any phone or an iPhone 4 that's been jailbroken?
That's one way to read that sentence.
Yeah.
For those of us who haven't jailbroken, the takeaway is that unless someone gets their physical hands on your phone, they can't abuse this. And so this is one of those.
I know why. I understand the sentence now. Because you can only jailbreak iOS 7.1.1 on an iPhone 4. That's the only place that jailbreak works. So 7.1.1 has the problem, but they would need physical access to your phone if it's a more current phone than an iPhone 4.
Because you couldn't have jailbroken. Okay, that makes sense. Sort of.
They could have made that clear.
Yes. So this is one of those ones where there's no patch yet. And Apple have said, yes, we acknowledge this exists. We are working on a fix. It will be included in a future software update. So for now, this one should just be on our mind. If you are emailing around spectacularly critical stuff, maybe don't. But that's actually not a bad piece of advice anyway.
Well, I was going to say, shouldn't you have encrypted it yourself?
Exactly, in which case, problem solved.
Yeah, so this doesn't mean they can undo that.
Right, it just means that, I have unfettered access to an encrypted file.
Yeah, okay, so Nocilla castaways are smarter than this anyway.
Yeah, but as I say, it's don't panic, be aware. And that's really all there is to it.
Okay.
Our friends over in Yahoo have put another nail in the coffin of the Do Not Track header, probably the final nail at this stage of the game. They have said they will stop honoring the header, and will track you anyway, no matter what you say. So effectively, the entire industry has basically given two fingers to the DNT, and it's dead, as far as I can see.
Okay.
Which is sad. But, yeah.
I was always on the other side of that argument.
Well...
But no, we've had it a few times.
The advertisers were going to agree that if people made an explicit choice they'd respect it, it was a good thing. And then Microsoft said, well, we're going to default this to on instead of off. And then the industry panicked and just went,
was the part I was not in favor of. Okay, got it.
So effectively, it's dead now. So it was a great idea while it lasted, but I don't see it having any use anymore since no one's actually honoring the header. Better news, Apple, Facebook, and other tech companies have said that they are going to notify their customers when law enforcement ask for their information, assuming, of course, that it is legal for them to do so. So in other words, everything shy of a gag order, they will tell you, which is making the feds cranky, but it is entirely legal, and it's another sign that the tech companies are trying to distance themselves, trying to sort of draw a clear line and say, no, we're on your side, we're not on their side.
I like that.
I do too. That's how it should be. I'm paying Apple. I expect them to be in my camp. Apple also released a very long document outlining exactly how they respond to exactly what. And exactly, do we need a subpoena for this? Or is just a discovery order enough? And basically outlining what they can give and what level of legal document is required for them to do that. So some things they will not do unless you get a full subpoena. Other things they will give out with just a warrant. You know, and basically they're just laying it all out. There's a lot to go through there. So my suggestion is rather than reading the whole thing, maybe read the summary that Ars Technica did, because that at least sort of hits on the key points. Or you could read it all if you like. A story that has, in my opinion, been taken out of all context is the leaking of some emails between major tech companies and the NSA. And everyone is interpreting these emails as Apple helped the NSA spy on its users and Google helped the NSA spy on its users.
Happily.
Yeah, but that's not actually a properly nuanced view of what we of what was leaked, because the NSA is a somewhat schizophrenic organization, which is usually fighting itself, because it actually has two jobs that are completely at odds with each other. It is supposed to be securing American infrastructure and American corporations, and it is supposed to be spying on people. And to help it spy on people, it has sabotaged encryption standards, which weakens companies are trying to protect. And these emails are very clearly the NSA doing the first half of the job, the good half, the helping keep American business and American infrastructure safe half, and they should be working with companies to do that. The problem is they don't undermine themselves with the other half. But in this case, I think it's the right side of the NSA, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, well, I was on the Daily Tech News show with Tom this week, and we were talking about that, and two things bothered me. There was an article from Gizmodo, I think it was, where they kept saying, and happily they went off and worked with the NSA. And I'm picturing people going, okay, I get to go with help the NSA. Yeah, you don't know that. Why are you even talking like that? It was just a poorly written article. And I apologize if it wasn't Gizmodo, but I think it was. But anyway, what Tom made a more intelligent response to that, he said that these meetings also took place before the disclosure by Snowden of everything else they were doing. So The presumption by those companies could easily have been, oh, the NSA is trying to protect the security of the environment here, and so we should help them.
Which so the they timing, are doing. The problem is they're also doing all the other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, no, they have to work together on securing infrastructure. They just have to work against each other on spying.
There we go.
Having one agency with those two jobs is nuts. Mm-hmm. But far be it from me to say how one should run such agencies. by the way, you mentioned, Tom, there the show last week on net neutrality was fantastic.
Oh, good, good. I'm glad you liked it.
And it also saved me taking a whole bunch of stories out of this week's security light.
Because you didn't have to explain it yourself.
Right? The fact that you guys had a big, long chat about it, it was really nice. And it is a very nuanced situation, and you covered that very well.
He has a phenomenal depth of knowledge in this stuff, and in a lot of stuff. He knows a lot of stuff.
So I guess doing tech news every day.
But you could do that and get a light understanding of a lot of stuff. He has a deep understanding of a lot of stuff.
Well,
yeah, and I think he has a lot of people on who have a lot of depth in a specific topic, and he actually listens to them and learns from them too. So smart guy.
Yeah. No, so I really enjoy that.
High praise. Good.
Snapchat have settled with the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, and as part of the settlement, they have agreed to 20 years.
I didn't know they were in trouble. What were they in trouble for?
Well, they were in trouble for telling everyone they deleted stuff straight away and then not deleting stuff straight away.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
And you're not supposed to tell people you'll do something as a corporation and then not do it.
Okay.
So they were in trouble and they have settled. And on the one hand, you could say they only got a slap on the wrist. On the other hand, they have 20 years of federal monitoring to look forward to. So actually, I think that's probably a good thing from users' point of view. It's probably
that's
the right
a
way
bad
to
thing
go.
From a taxpayer's point of view. Good Lord. We're going to pay somebody from the federal government to monitor a Snapchat application for 20 years?
Well, not the application, the company.
Okay, yeah, but what the application's doing.
Part of your budget.
Yeah, but every one of these adds up forever. They never go away. Nothing ever stops either.
Well, in 20 years it will.
Mm-hmm. Now, that person will still be drawing a paycheck, and Snapchat won't even exist anymore, and we'll have not noticed that guy's actually at home playing video games.
Well, you know, it is possible that bureaucracies are misrun like that. I'm sure you're not going to say they're not. But in this case, I kind of think this is kind of the best outcome, because the other way this could have gone was they could have simply snapped them with a fine for 2 million quid and bankrupted them.
Mm.
So I think saying, okay, you may continue to do business, but you really did boob here. Therefore, you can continue to do business, but we're going to make sure that you don't do that again. So, you know, there's two ways of looking at it.
It's kind of funny that I'm the cynical one today.
That's usually my job, yeah.
I know, switching places. All right, what else can I be cranky about?
Well, this really does just affect Americans. Those nice people at Verizon have decided that they're going to start using your desktop to track you so they can send you ads to your mobile. And if you'd like to opt out, the instructions are in the show notes, kindly provided by the Mac Observer.
So George from Tulsa posted about this on our Google Plus community, and I find it interesting. We were chatting beforehand about people who are worried about being tracked and yet use Google services, and George is one of the big proponents of using Android. So I find it kind of interesting to worry about something like this. Like, so what? They're going to serve me ads. I don't know.
Yeah, but what they're doing is they're basically saying that if you use our services on your desktop, then we get to tie. Yeah, I don't like it. You can opt out. That's good. I do not like people I pay. It's one thing for a free service like Google to expect a pound of flesh, but Verizon are not a free service.
Ah, that's a good point.
Right? So if I'm paying a company, we have a relationship. I'm the customer. You provide me a service. I am not the product to be sold. I am the customer. And I consider it double dipping. You know, you have my money. You don't get to exploit me too. No. Anyway, I've left the two best stories to the end. So good news from Facebook, which I don't say often, but what? Here we go. Okay. They have, right, one of the biggest problems with Facebook apps is that as soon as you use the app, you give the app developer, like, all of your information.
And that means you have to click yes to everything. You don't even get to pick and choose, right?
Yeah. So some guy develops a silly little game and starts harvesting information for nefarious use. Easy to do. What Google, or not Google, Facebook have decided to do to tackle this is to allow anonymous login to Facebook apps. So in other words, you show up to the app as if you're just a brand new Facebook user with nothing in your account yet.
Ooh.
Which of course is only which is perfect for games because they have no reason to know any more about you. But obviously it would be silly for apps that do things which involve your information, you know, to help you plan parties and stuff. So obviously this anonymous login is only useful for situations where the app having access to your information doesn't give you any benefit. But
yeah,
it's still good.
I can see that. Like, if it's something where it's an app that allows you to post photos to Facebook, it would need access. What bothers me, though, is that if I said yes to that, it's going to say, and I can post on your behalf whenever I want to. Now,
unfortunately, that problem has not gone away yet. But nonetheless, this is still a positive development, this concept that you can be anonymous to some apps, where that makes sense. So, you know, it's a sensible feature to implement.
Good.
May not be a panacea, but it's good. And I think I've mentioned a few times that Google were getting in a lot of hot water from parent groups for harvesting the information in students' inboxes in apps for education.
Yeah.
They have stopped. They have caved into the pressure and said, oh, okay, we give up, which is good. So that's a step forward. And that does make it more likely that schools will become Google customers if Google treat them like customers.
That's good.
Our notable breaches bit, the usual story here. I'm not going to go into them unless they... So if they affect you, have a read in the show notes. There was a wee whoopsie over in Apple where their developer portal had a bug that allowed anyone without properly authenticating to get at all Apple staff and all registered Apple developers' contact details, including Mr. Cook and all sorts of people. So that was interesting.
But they worked on that one quickly.
they did. They shut down the whole developer system, fixed it, and brought it back up. A very quick response, which I guess makes sense. Kind of a whoopsie. AOL had a whoopsie on their email stuff. They're telling everyone to change the passwords, and Bitly got breached and didn't bother telling us any information, so you probably want to go reset your Bitly password if you have one.
Hmm.
Suggested reading, there's a whole bunch of these here I'm not even going to mention. If you're interested, have a read in the show notes, but there's just four I want to draw attention to because I think they're very interesting. Stanford have released a new password policy, which sounds boring, right? Password policy, ooh. But they've done something spectacularly clever. Instead of deciding on a one rule fits all, they have basically said, the longer you make your password, the less we care about what you put into it. The shorter you make your password, the more restrictions we're going to put on it. So if it's a short password, it has to be uppercase, lowercase, symbols, numbers. If it's more than 20 characters long, have at it. Do whatever you like. The length is your protection. And they've done up posters showing you, you know, what the rules are for different lengths of passwords. And I think this is spectacularly forward thinking. And I really hope that lots of people take this notion on board and that we finally get sane password policies.
That's it. I got a noodle in my head why that's true. That's interesting.
Okay, well, the longer your password is, the bigger the haystack.
Sure.
Therefore, the less it matters whether it's a big alphabet or a little alphabet.
So you're saying if my password were the Gettysburg Address, that would be super secure?
Even though it's all letters. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, because think of the amount of time it would take to brute force all that possible combinations of that many characters, right. So it doesn't matter that there's no exclamation points in there. Well, there might be exclamation points. No percentage signs.
Right.
So I think it's, and they've done up some nice graphics and stuff to illustrate it. So I'm hoping other people will sort of use this as an example. Symantec did something very interesting. They admitted to, I think it was the Wall Street Journal, that AV, as we know it, is dead. And they're basically talking about the fact that they need to do different things in the future. Antivirus.
Oh, I think so, an audiovisual. I'm going, nope, we got no more projectors.
No, the AV club is fine. Don't worry. Antivirus is, they basically this idea of wait for the bad guys to do something, find the signature, then push that signature out to everyone's computer to protect them. That's dead because the bad guys are making more viruses than anyone can ever protect against. They're obfuscating them. But this interview in the New York Times, which is worth reading anyway, inspired Brian Krebs to do a little sort of retrospective on how we've gotten from there was no antivirus to here. And it's kind of, it's an interesting battle between the defenders and the attackers. And so if you're ever curious, I would highly recommend having read that Brian Krebs article because he writes well and it's kind of an interesting perspective on things. The other thing I wanted to mention is that you had mentioned the cool feature in Whatchamajigger LastPass that showed you when websites were naughty, when they had lost passwords or how they had done on the Heartbleed thing.
Right.
And we had said that 1Password didn't have that, which was true. They have released a new feature called Watchtower, which basically puts a little red banner across your thingy whenever you go to a site that has a known problem.
So Don McAllister sent out an email to people who had were subscribed at Screencast Online, and he said he was able to verify that they didn't have the Heartbleed problem, and their certificate had not been renewed for his certificate had not been renewed for a long time. 1Password recorded that as still a problem because it didn't have a new certificate. So even though so he never had the Heartbleed problem,
off it, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so there are some.
Be something to look at.
It, yeah.
Necessary but not sufficient, you know.
Yeah, okay. That's well, hopefully it gets a little better with time.
Yeah, he said the certificate's going to get updated any minute now anyway, so it won't look bad, but he said not to worry.
Yeah, certificates aren't free if you're a corporation, so that's a little worrying because people shouldn't be bullied into buying new certificates needlessly. Unless it was due to expire, in which case, okay, fair enough. But anyway, the last thing just to mention is just a final sort of wrap up on the Target breach. It has claimed its highest victim. The CEO is now also gone, having followed the CTO, I think it was, out the door. But the positive out of all of this, which I think is worth trying to find one, is that Target will be one of the first companies in the United States to implement chip and PIN.
Oh, yay.
So having been horribly bitten, they are now quite keen to be at the front of this next security revolution. So I thought that was sort of an interesting way to find at least some good in a really quite bad whoopsie.
You know, my mom and dad went out and bought a Ford Pinto right after they started blowing up in the 1970s. Well, no, they did it on purpose. They said, what car do you think is the safest car being built right now?
Oh, it's after the Ford Pinto.
Yeah, you want to fly the airline that just crashed. That's the good one.
That's actually, yeah, it's, I don't know if you're familiar with the story of the first jetliner. The de Havilland Comet. You ever hear about this? So they built the first ever passenger jetliner as a British company, de Havilland. And the thing was, it looked like something from the space age. It had these, like, the engines were built into the wings and these smooth, you know, sort of streamlined. It was silver. It looked amazing. It had square windows.
Okay.
They didn't know about metal fatigue yet.
Oh, jeez.
So it was fine for a year. They were flying people around the world in style, and then they started falling out of the sky.
Oh, jeez.
And no one knew why. And the de Havilland Comet 2 came about when they discovered why. They basically stuck a comet into a tank. They filled it with water, pressurized the water on the inside to be a different pressures of the water on the outside to simulate compression, decompression, compression, decompression. And then they had a hydraulic jack shake the wings up and down. And after 2 months of this, a crack came from the corner of the window. But because it was just water, the thing didn't fall out of the sky, so they could actually see what went wrong.
It just sank.
Yeah, right. And so the de Havilland 2 had round windows and was one of the safest airplanes in the world. But unfortunately, the Comet 1 was so bad it bankrupted the entire company, and which is why you don't hear de Havilland anymore. They were the first airliners.
Wow. My parents would have flown them.
Yeah, absolutely, because the Comet 2 was a fantastic airplane. Hmm. You know, unfortunately, the Comet 1, not so much.
Well, let's hope
anyway,
that
so there is,
gets a
there
better
is a bunch,
fate.
Yeah. There is a bunch more suggested reading. We will not be talking about it because we have some terminal to tame.
Yay!
Or some regular expressions to tame.
Vegetables eaten.
Yes.
So this is part 18, Bart. You realize that?
I know. Yeah, and we're not even halfway through the stuff we could talk about. I had no
idea.
Are we
going to have to go back and change the end to a real number when we're done?
If we're ever done.
Okay.
If we ever do pick a number for N, then it's going to end up being, you know, part 22 of, you know, of N minus 1 or something. Anyway.
Right.
So where we had left off, we had started to look at POSIX extended regular expressions, or POSIX ERE, and we had gone through sort of the basic stuff. A letter represents itself, two letters represents two of itself. What else would we do? A dot represented any letter. The little hat meant start of line. The little dollar meant end of line. Inside the square brackets, we could have like a list of characters to match. So an A or a B or a C or a D, just put them in the square brackets, close it off, call it character class. We could be lazy and have like A minus Z or A to Z, 0 to 9. They were allowed in those character classes to make life easier. And that's kind of where we stopped.
Right. That was
and
fun.
I left you.
I was excited about the part of wrecking crossword puzzles.
Yes, exactly, because you could use a dot symbol. We'd left off sort of as a teaser with a really horrible regular expression that was like full of icky repetition. And I said that if, as a computery person, you see something like this, it should set off your brain going, there has to be a better way because this is ugly. And so we're going to find a way by the end of this. We're going to revisit that horrible regular expression when we're done here today, and we'll be able to replace it with a much neater one that's easier to read and way shorter.
Good.
So before we go into the thing we're going to be talking about pretty much the entire time, which is how you do repetition, we have one more little thing to finish off with our friends, the character class. So inside those square brackets. So the last time we said that if you find any word beginning with a vowel, you could have like the little hat sign for beginning of line, then your open square bracket, A-E-I-O-U, close square bracket, and that would have anything beginning with a vowel. Great. What if you want anything that doesn't begin with a vowel? What if you actually want the inverse of that? Everything that's not a vowel. You could write out all the letters that are not vowels, but that's kind of messy. So you can negate a character class. You could invert it by using the little hat symbol as the first character in the character class, which is slightly confusing because what that means is that the little hat symbol has two meanings.
Yeah, what did the hat symbol mean before?
Start of line.
Start of line, okay.
So when it's used outside of square brackets, it means start of line. When it's used as the first character inside the square brackets, it means everything after it is to be inverted. So if you wanted to find every five-letter word that does not start with a vowel, you could use the command in the first command in today's show notes. So egrep, hat for start of line, open your character class, hat, A-E-I-O-U, close character class, and then four dots to get us up to five, and then our dollar sign for the end of the line. And so if you run that, you will see that it does indeed do all of that. And there are all your five-letter words that don't begin with a vowel.
Huh. Okay.
So
they use the same thing to mean two different things?
They ran out of character. I don't know. Maybe they got bored on their keyboard. They've kind of used most of them. And I think they sort of want us to, yeah, I don't know, but they did.
Because they're mean. Okay.
Yeah, they did it a long time ago, so we can't even go ask them. So that's our, no, that's basically our inverted character classes. The other thing that you're likely to want to do, if you're talking in English and you're describing a pattern, you'll very often find yourself using the word or.
Right.
Well, the pattern is this or this. And we haven't yet come across the ability to have an or in what we've talked about so far. And this is another slightly recycled symbol, but it's recycled in a different way. So the symbol for or in a POSIX ERE is the pipe, the vertical line, the pipe symbol.
Oh, really?
Yes. Which is why you, which is yet another reason to get into the habit of always quoting your regular expressions, because if you don't quote it, Bash will think it knows what that means and try to do a redirection operation instead of passing the symbol on into egrep. So
right.
By using
that's what I thought quotes, it meant.
Yeah. So which that is what it means to Bash, but in regular expressions it means something else. So by quoting a regular expression, we're stopping Bash from getting into it. We're telling, you know, the single quotes basically mean, "Dear Bash, this is not for you. Just pass this through, hand it on to whatever the command is."
This is not the command you're looking for.
Right, none of your business, just pass it on. Sealed envelope. Whoosh, away with you. So again, this is why I sort of said last time, it's very important to get into the habit of always using single quotes around your regular expressions, because otherwise you'll accidentally use a dollar and it won't mean what you think it means, or you'll accidentally use a pipe and it won't mean what you think it means.
Ah, right, right. Okay.
So the or sign is simply the pipe. So as an example, we have a regular expression defined: every five-letter word that starts with a TH or ends in ING. Kind of arbitrary, but look, you can do these things. So egrep, again, the hat symbol for start of line, TH and then three dots, dollar. In other words, that's going to match.
Wait, we have a quote first.
Starting in TH. Then we have our pipe for or, and then we have start of line, two dots, ING, dollar, which is the other half of our or statement. Stick them all together, run the command, and it does what it says in the tin. Or rather,
sorry,
it does what I just said.
I talked over you a little bit because you didn't say the quote part, but egrep, the quote, and then the hat symbol, TH, dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, I'm trying to only say the important stuff because I figure people have to read the show notes anyway.
That's true. What did the dollar sign mean again?
So the dollar sign is end of line.
End of line. Okay, so the hat is the beginning of line, dollar sign's the end of line.
Yeah, and remember, we're doing all of this on the words file, which is one word per line.
Okay.
So start of line and end of line also means start of word, end of word.
Okay. Right.
Then one other thing that's very important for us to learn is that it's possible to sort of create sub-patterns or groupings. And we do that with the parentheses or the round brackets. And an example for this would be if you wanted to find all seven-letter words that start with TH or AB. So you could do that the long way and have like TH and then five dots or AB and five dots. But actually, why don't we just take the first bit of the word and group it together and then put our five dots after that, because that's always the same. Hmm. And so with the brackets, we can simply say TH or AB followed by five of anything.
Okay.
And that will be, trust me, you're about to see why that's really important. Because so, repetition is not going to be over the entire string, is it?
How am I going to remember all this?
Practice.
Well, you have really good show notes, so that's good.
And there's near the bottom of these show notes, there's a very nice little summary that is probably going to be the most helpful, because what you're going to need once you know what a regular expression can do is not sort of a primer from first principle, but a little list of what symbol means that again? I know there is a symbol for end of line. What was it?
Okay, good. So we don't necessarily have to remember every bit of syntax. You're going to help us with that, but remembering that that exists and it's something we can do is important.
Yeah, and to me, there's no learning by rote in IT because we have the Googles. Mm-hmm. What you need to do is you need to understand the concepts and you need to know what's possible, and then you can go search for it.
Right, right.
That's how I always do things, which is why I think every IT exam should be open book. Because it shouldn't be examining what you've learned off by rote. It should be examining what you understand. But anyway, I digress. So our groupings are just a way of effectively addressing a sub-part of, a little sub-pattern. And that's going to become really important when we start to include repetition, because you're probably going to want to apply that repetition to just a part of the pattern. It's unlikely that the whole thing is repeated.
Ah, okay.
And now we get on to the repetition stuff, or cardinalities, as I think is the fancy word for things that happen multiple numbers of times.
Okay.
There are four operators that can that you can use to describe different types of repetition. The first of them is one that you may find confusing because you've seen it before, therefore you think you know what it means. If I said to you the star operator, what do you think that means?
Usually that's a wild card, right?
Right. Not here.
Oh, jeez. Okay. So a hat doesn't mean a hat, and a pipe doesn't mean a pipe, and a star doesn't mean a star. Got it.
Yes. Okay, it's a different language, right? It has to use the same characters because no one's installed a new keyboard. So they have to take different meanings in different contexts. So the star you should mentally read as zero or more occurrences of. And the very important thing to note is that the star does not apply to everything that comes before it. It applies only to the character directly to its left or the group directly to its left.
Okay. So
if you had a pattern T, O star P, that would match top and toop if it existed. Not, you know, it only applies to the O. It only applies to the thing just next to it. The one thing on its left, and that one thing can be a group defined by the brackets we just learned about.
Boy, this is getting thick, Bart.
I know. Hopefully, so, the practical examples are what's going to help us out here.
Let me see if I can say it again, and I am reading the show notes. So the star means zero or more occurrences of. So if there's an O to the left of the star, it means one O, two O's, three O's, four O's, whatever
or zero
you find.
O's.
Oh, well, what good is it then if it can mean zero O's? What's the O even there?
There are many times where something is optional. If you think about it,
what OR is for? That's what we got the pipe for.
No, but okay, think of domain names, right? You have to have one bit of a domain name, and then you can have zero or more times a dot followed by another one. Localhost is a valid domain name. There's no dot in that. So you can have zero. Whereas podfeet.com is a valid domain. www.podfeet.com is a valid name. So zero or more is very useful.
Okay. Keep going.
Okay. So I've sort of done a bit of a contrived example here. So th dot star ing. So anything that starts with a th has any amount from zero to infinity of some other letter and then ends in ing. And that is going to match thing. Because thing has a th, then absolutely nothing, and then ing. So the important thing is that thing matches. Ooh. Should have picked a better example.
Say it one more time as you walked through. Say you got th dot star ing.
Yeah. So the star only applies to the dot, which we know means one of anything.
Zero.
So we can have the letters T, the letters H, then any amount of anything,
including zero,
including none.
Right.
Then ing. And so if you run that, you'll start to see what that all does.
Okay.
And the important thing that I will say is that if you look through that, thing is in there because it's about one page. It's about two pages up if you scroll. You'll see that thing. So th, absolutely nothing, ing, is matched by that, as is thinking, thinkling, thinning, thirdling. What is a thirdling?
Thomasing? Anyway, there's all made-up words in here.
There's a lot of made-up words in here. Thread making. That's a good one.
Okay.
Threatening.
Because they have th, some number of something.
Yeah, any number of anything, including none at all.
Okay.
ing. Okay? So the operator that I think your brain wants to like is actually very close by. It is the plus, which if you think about it, is a star with a few less diagonals. And the plus means one or more. Okay? Star is zero or more, plus is one or more.
That sounds good. Plus is more than star. Got it?
Okay. Yeah, and pluses are also very useful. You use them an awful lot in regular expressions. And exact the same thing. So if you do the same regular expression as before, but we replace our star with a plus, we'll get exact the same answer, except that thing will have gone.
Oh.
So if you do a if you pipe it into WC minus L, you'll see that there's one less answer.
Okay.
So we get 39 with the plus, and we'll get 40 with the star.
All right. We still have thimble making, but no thing. Got it.
Exactly, okay. Because the plus means one or more. Therefore, thing does not match the pattern because nothing is less than one.
Hmm. Okay.
Then the last of the simple ones is the question mark, which you can read as zero or one occurrences of, or I prefer to say optionally.
But not many.
Yeah,
it's
so
zero, one.
It can be there once or it can be there not at all, but that's it. And a very common place you will see this is in any regular expression that tries to match a URL, because it will be HTTPS question mark, because the S may or may not be there.
Oh, right.
And there's quite a few things. Like a URL will often end with a slash, but people often leave the slash off. So when I'm doing regular expressions, in fact, one of the places I use regular expressions all the time is in reverse proxy, is in when we're doing very intelligent redirects on web servers. And most of my redirects end with slash question mark, because the same URL with or without the trailing slash, yeah, it's valid. In fact, I'm pretty sure if you look at that htaccess file we wrote for you all those months ago, you'll find a whole bunch of slash question marks in it.
I think there are, yeah.
I'm pretty sure you can go to podfeet.com/Twitter or podfeet.com/Twitter/ and get the same result.
Yeah. Right.
And that's another place regular expressions are used, or in redirects on web servers. And so if you now go back and look at that htaccess file after we finish today, that'll make more sense than it did the day we wrote it.
Oh, I wasn't supposed to be doing that right now.
Well, you can do that right now if you like.
Okay, just you keep talking now. I'll be right back.
So we have a different example in the show notes for the question mark. So we have one there that will find every word that ends with ing or ings. So in other words, it's ing, S question mark dollar. So the S is optional and the dollar means end of line. So in other words, anything that ends in ing or ings. And that means that winning matches, as does winnings.
Okay. I ran the example, but it came up with so many things I lost track of what it was trying to do.
So it's every word that ends in ing or ings, which is a lot, because the English language is very fond of ing. We do a lot of ings.
Okay.
So they're the three simple ones. Zero or more, one or more, zero or one.
Okay.
But there are arbitrarily many different types of repetition you could have, right? And so there's a catch-all. There's an operator we use for all of the not simple stuff. And so the operator is the curly brackets. And so there's three ways you can use it legally. So you can have curly bracket, some number, close curly bracket. And that means whatever that number is, times. So 4 times would be open curly bracket, 4, close curly bracket. 400 times would be open curly bracket, 400, close curly bracket. But it means exactly whatever number I've put in the curly brackets.
Wait, what am I doing numbers for now?
This is for repetitions. Let's say your pattern says that you want something repeated exactly 7 times. Okay. Open curly bracket, 7, close curly bracket. That means exactly 7.
Why would I want that?
Think of an IP address that's 4 bits. Exactly 4. You can't add more numbers to the end because then it's not true anymore.
But it's not a repetition.
Well, it is, because it's a number followed by 3 times dot number dot number dot number. Trust me. Well, we'll see in a minute exactly why this. Okay. IP addresses are good. Trust me.
Okay.
So just like with the star, the plus, and the question mark, it applies to the one thing to its left. So if you want 4 A's, it's A, open curly bracket, 4, close curly bracket. That means 4 A's.
Oh.
100 A's, it's A, open curly bracket, 400, close curly bracket.
Okay.
So I think 4 A's is no shorter than really just typing 4 A's. But 400 A's is an awful lot shorter if you just do it with the curly brackets.
Right.
And remember, we can use round brackets to make a group, so we can repeat something more complex whatever amount of times we want.
Okay.
The other way to do it is with two numbers. So open curly bracket, one number, comma, another number, close the curly bracket. And that means at least the first number of times, but but no more than the second number of times, or between. So okay. You can have between 5 and 8 of these, whatever you like. And then the last one is just one number, comma, and then you leave the last number blank. And blank effectively means infinity. In other words, at least 4, or at least 100.
Huh, okay.
So an empty space means infinity is how you remember that one.
Is it an empty space or nothing there?
As in, it's just nothing. So it's basically open curly bracket, end comma, close the curly bracket straight away. So nothingness is infinity.
Okay.
That's profound, actually, when you think about it, but let's not do that. So now we actually have the ability to shorten our regular expressions quite considerably. So the regular expression to find every 10-letter word is simply the little hat for start of line, dot for anything, open curly bracket, 10, close curly bracket, dollar. That's every 10-letter word. Every word between 10 and 12 letters long, inclusive. Same thing, only 10 comma 12.
I'm sorry. Go back. How do you get the list of all 10-letter words again?
Okay, so it's the regular expression is the little hat sign for start of line.
Right.
The dot symbol for one of anything.
Okay.
Open the curly bracket, 10, close the curly bracket. So in other words, 10 of whatever just came before, 10 of anything. Dollar.
Okay. Okay. So that says, because of the dot, that tells me I'm looking for something. I want to see 10 of something.
So whenever you see the curly brackets, whatever is directly to its left is what you're having 10 of.
Okay.
Or 20 of, or whatever you put into the number. So if you run that one, you'll see that it's very, it's very easy to see what it's doing, because on the terminal with the fixed width font, they'll all be exactly the same width as they scroll by. They're all exactly 10 if you'd care to count them. There's lots of them.
That's really pretty. Zootechnic.
It's pretty, yeah.
Oh, come on. These are made up words. Zootherapy.
Yeah, I don't know what you have to do to get into this dictionary. We did discover a Dutch/Flemish word for sparrow, didn't we?
Yeah.
So goodness knows what's in here.
Phytoid.
The other one then is for our between. So for one, at least 10 up to 12. So if you do that one, it's hat start of line dot one of anything, open your curly brackets, 10 comma 12, close your curly brackets, dollar, is every word that's at least 10 long, no more than 12 long. And so when you do that, you'll see it jiggling in and out, but only by 2.
Got it.
So
got
it picks 10-letter words, 11-letter words, and 12-letter words. And then the last one is not a long list. It's the words longer than 15 characters, or 15 or longer, which is 15 comma. Just no ending number.
That's actually a fair number of words.
It is.
I'm scrolling.
A lot of them are pretty makey-uppy looking to me. Urethrocystanastomosis. Don't want one of those. No idea what it is, but I think it involves peeing.
Soliloquizingly. That's awesome. Wait. Slubberdegullion. That's my favorite one.
Okay, that one wins. No point keeping reading, you won.
What was it you called it? Make-uppingly?
No. Make-uppingly, yeah. So that gives us the ability to specify pretty much every type of repetition you're likely to come across. So 0 or more, 1 or more, optional, or anything in between you like. So that's pretty powerful. The last thing we have to do is we have to have mention of special characters, because all of these special characters that we've now met all the operators, they all mean something inside a regular expression. So what if you want to search for a dot?
Oh.
Right? Dot means anything, but what if I actually want a dot? What if I'm looking for MAC addresses? Or sorry, not MAC addresses, IP addresses. I want number, dot, number, dot, number, dot, number. I want the dot. I'm trying to actually find an actual dot.
Yeah.
What if I actually want to find a dollar sign? I'm looking for dollar amounts. I want a dollar sign, some digits, and then optionally a dot and some more digits. Right? I want the dot. I want the dollar. What if I want a star? You get the idea. So if we want to if we actually mean the character, and if that character has a meaning in the part of the regular expression we're in, we just put a backslash in front of it, and then we escape the special character. So a dot is backslash dot.
But even so, even if there's a star or a plus to the right of it, it won't look at it?
Yeah, the backslash basically means whatever comes after me doesn't mean the operator, it means the actual symbol. So backslash star means the symbol star, not zero or many.
Okay.
And if you want an actual backslash, it's backslash backslash.
So if you were looking for something that had a dollar sign at the end, it would be backslash dollar sign dollar sign.
Correct. The first dollar sign would be protected by the backslash. The second dollar sign would have its real meaning in regular expression terms.
Wow.
Perfect. So I've listed here all of the special characters, which is conveniently a list of all of the operators that we've come across.
The half symbol
means start with when it's outside a character class or not if it's inside a character class. Dollar means end with. Dot means any one character. Your opening, your square brackets mean start and end a character class. Your minus sign is the range operator. Your round brackets are your groupings. Your pipe is your or. Your star is your zero or more. Your plus is your one or more. Your question mark is your zero or one. Your curly brackets are your cardinalities. And your backslash is the escape character. So that's actually a short list of everything.
That's a good cheat sheet there.
Yeah. So given what we know now, we can now start to do more real-world examples. So we're putting the dictionary away. Okay. Mm. So we're just going to create these. I have nothing to search some of these against, but we'll remedy that in a moment as well. So just as an academic exercise, we're going to look at the pattern to find temperatures, by which I mean there has to be a number, which is the temperature. It may or may not have a decimal part, and then it should end with either C for Celsius, F for Fahrenheit, or K for Kelvin. And that should be a pattern we can create now, because we've learned all the bits to make that up. So the first thing is we want a number. So what is a number?
0 to 9.
It's one or more digits, right? Because 1,000 is a number, but that's 3 digits.
But it's negatives too.
Ah, okay, good point. My example in the show notes is only for positives, therefore... Okay, if we want to include negatives, then it would be the minus sign, question mark, at the front of what we have in the show notes.
Ah, because it could or could not have a question mark, got it.
It may or may not be present, exactly.
Okay.
So we can describe...
Could or could not have a minus symbol, I said that wrong. I said could or could not have a question mark. It's the question mark says you may or may not have the minus symbol. Got it.
I actually heard that the right way, even though you said it the wrong way.
Yeah, that's what I was worried about, and everybody think I was right.
So we know how to do one digit, right? It's open square bracket, 0-9, close square bracket. Mm-hmm. So if we stick a plus after it, we now turn it into one or more digits. In other words, a number. A whole number.
Okay.
Then we want the decimal bit. And so the decimal bit has to be grouped because the whole thing is optional. So we open a pair of round brackets and put a question mark after it. And then we try to fill in the bits inside. So we want an actual full stop.
Oh, because this is going to be an optional. It could be 23 degrees Fahrenheit, but it might be 23.4.
Exactly.
Okay.
So we're going to create the grouping by using the round brackets and stick a question mark after it. And then we're going to go step inside and actually figure out the inside bit.
Okay.
So if it is a decimal, the first thing we're expecting to meet after the number is an actual period, an actual full stop symbol. So backslash dot.
Got it.
Now we come back to where you know how to get a digit, open square bracket, 0-9, close square bracket, and we can have really an arbitrary number of, you know, digits after the decimal point, right? So another plus. So
and plus meant one or more?
One or more. So in other words, if you have the decimal point, we do want there to be at least one digit.
Could you have done a star and gotten rid of the question mark? Because star would have meant zero or more. I guess you would have still had the
decimal points. The star only applies to the one thing to its left, which is the 0 to 9.
So it would have had to have a dot, but no number, which makes no sense.
Precisely.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So in order to make this really quite precise, I've grouped them and stuck the question mark in the end.
I was just trying to prove I was paying attention.
And then the very last thing is a character class on the end for C, F, or K, which are the 3 symbols we're allowing.
Which we do in square brackets again.
Yeah. So in that example, we have used the vast majority of what we've learned in one simple example. Haven't managed to squeeze an OR in, but you know, we're not doing too bad there. But you can see how these cardinality operators are really quite useful.
Wait a minute, wait a minute. Sorry, back up. You probably explained it last week, but why can I say square bracket CFK and it means C or F or K?
Because that's what a character class is.
Oh, it already has an or?
Effectively, you should read it as if it's an or. It means any one of these, but only one of them.
Okay.
So effectively, that means C or F or K, right? You could read it okay. that way, but it takes a lot of reading. So as another example, how's about we try to find decimal dollar amounts? They're going to start with a dollar sign, because that's what a dollar sign means. So backslash dollar, because dollar is one of our special characters. Open square bracket 0 to 9 plus. We're now getting very used to seeing that, because that's our I'll have a digit, please. Plus
any,
means
any
I'll have
many of them. Like.
So plus is a whole number. Again, I have decided that our bank balances are all positive, so I forgot about the minus.
Good, good. I like that.
And then we've done the same thing. We've used the brackets and the question mark on the end to simply wrap around and say a full stop, so backslash dot, followed by more digits, one or okay. more digits. So now we
this
have
is actually
two
starting to read like it makes sense to me, Bart.
And this is real. This isn't made-y-uppy stuff. This is things we might actually want to go find. Right? Finding dollar amounts is probably something we might want to do in a file. So this is getting real.
Okay.
Now, it is considered best practice, and I agree entirely, so try avoid those annoying backslashes because they make your code hard to read. So there is a trick which I recommend everyone do as a best practice. So you only have to escape a special character if it has meaning in its current context. So if it's in the body of the regular expression, dot always has a meaning. But if it's inside a character class, almost no symbol has a special meaning inside a character class. So we can use character classes to avoid backslashes.
Oh, okay.
So I can rewrite those two examples more succinctly using square brackets. So 0 to 9 plus, and then instead of having a backslash dot, I can put the dot inside square brackets, which is
it's
in my mind.
It's not actually more succinctly, it's more clear.
You're right, actually, because there's one extra character.
Yeah, but it reads better.
Exactly. And the same for the dollar example below. It reads nicer having the dollar in the square brackets and the dot in the square brackets. Now, if you want to get a hat, you always have to backslash it, because a hat has a meaning in both contexts. So you just can't avoid it. And so you can never get your backslashes down to zero for every possible thing. But using the square brackets, you can get your backslashes down to a lot lower than they would be otherwise. And so it's considered best practice to avoid the backslashes unless you have no choice. Okay, now in my preparation, I'd actually planned to continue on in this episode the whole way to the end of regular expressions. But we have looked at our clocks and apparently we had too much fun in Security Light.
You know what? This is what happens, Bart, when we have too much fun, when we haven't talked to each other for too long. I can't help myself.
And it's good. I mean, it means that there's meat in those topics. So I guess we'll be bold and give another teaser so that we'll wrap it up next time.
Okay. So in a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, 2 weeks?
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
All right.
We'll have the final, the second part of the, anyway, we'll finish it off.
Okay, so next time, what's our teaser for next time?
Well, we still have, basically, I had promised you that we would sort of put it all together, and there's a few more shortcuts that'll make our regular expressions shorter, and then we're going to put it all together, revisit the big examples that we'd looked at the start, that I said, this will make sense to you when we're finished, and also, I can make this regular expression for a MAC address way shorter, and also that one I promised was a joke.
Oh, right, you did.
I did, and I do promise we will come to that, and hopefully you will laugh.
It's going to be a first month-long wait for the punchline.
Yeah, I have a feeling I may have big upped it too much.
Nerd humor can never be up too much. All right, Bart, we'll talk to you again next time then.
Indeed, and until then, happy computing.
Well, I had a lot of fun with that. I know it's getting pretty deep, and I sure hope you guys go over to the show notes over at bartb.ie and look up, what is it, show 17A of N that we're on now. And I hope you don't mind that I cut him off and we decided to move it out to another week because it was getting a little bit long, but it was a good tease, I think. Anyway, that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping to pay the bills, Blue Mango Learning at bluemangolearning.com, makers of Clarify. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions. When's the last time I had a truly dumb question? You guys keep sending me in hard questions, and then I say, well, I'll just send it over Google Plus, and somebody like Steve Davidson or George or Kirshen or somebody like that will go answer it. So anyway, do send me in your dumb questions. Once you're so embarrassed to ask, you just, you know, you gotta ask somebody privately. You know, those are the ones I want. I would also like comments and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter and app.net at Podfeet. Check out the NoSillaCast Google Plus community. Like I said, I'm using it as a resource now, so you guys should get the advantage of that too. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. Like a whole slew of people, including Chris and Brett, have been coming back. Barry's here. Rose from Australia. Paul Shadwell, he's in here from Switzerland. We're a global community over there in the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilla Castaways. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.